This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Josh Geltzer is a deputy assistant to the president, deputy White House counsel, and legal advisor to the National Security Council. Josh was on our show just a few weeks ago to discuss the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a law critical to our national security. And Josh is back again today for more discussion about 702. We will be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io. Josh, welcome back to the show.
Michael, thanks so much for the chance to join you again.
So I want to start by explaining to my listeners why we're having you back on the show so soon after we last had you. We have never done this before. So why now? And the answer to that question is that my co-host, Andy Macritas, and I both believe strongly that the reauthorization of Section 702 of the FISA Act is critically important to the nation. It's that simple. Important topics get a larger slice of time on the podcast, and critically important ones get most of the time. And in my mind, 702 is in that category. So I just wanted to explain to everybody why we're doing this so soon again. So Josh, let's just dig in here. For those listeners who missed the first show, let's review some of our discussion from last time. What is 702 and what does it authorize the government to do?
It's the perfect place to dig back in, and I'm grateful for the chance to do it. So the one sentence version is that Section 702 of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, authorizes the executive branch of the U.S. government in a court-supervised way to work with U.S. electronic communications service providers, think tech companies, in order to obtain certain communications by targeting only non-U.S. persons located abroad when that information is anticipated to be of foreign intelligence value. It's the one sentence version, though admittedly it's a long sentence. The longer version is that we have had for decades something called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. We'll probably refer to that in the conversation, Michael, as traditional FISA, which has really focused on foreign intelligence collection against Americans or others on U.S. soil. And then there has been no statutory framework, because the Constitution doesn't require one, for collecting against non-U.S. persons located abroad. That's been done under executive order, EO 12333. But something happened to change around 9/11, in which non-U.S. persons outside the United States were using U.S. technologies. And many of them, of course, use U.S. technologies to do perfectly wonderful things, the way we all use these technologies. But some of them use them to do hostile things. And in particular, after 9/11, it became clear that terrorists were using our country's own technologies to try to recruit and radicalize and plot, including recruiting Americans in the homeland. And so this authority was developed as a compromise by Congress and the executive branch at the time to target for collection non-U.S. persons located abroad who have no constitutional rights, but to do so in a court-supervised way because the companies that are being relied on for the communications are U.S. companies. And that has produced Section 702 of FISA, which has been reauthorized multiple times and signed into law multiple times by presidents of both parties.
So it's the change in technology, and it's the adversary's use of that technology that is the reason why the IC needs this authority.
I think that's exactly right. And terrorists may have been the first category of bad actors who were using U.S. technology in this way, at least with a prominence that led to the passing of this authority. But others have followed suit. And we're now at a moment where hostile foreign powers, as they attempt to recruit spies in our midst in the United States, will use U.S. communications technologies. Proliferators will use these same technologies. Those who move the precursor chemicals that become fentanyl in our communities that kill Americans at a dreadful scale, they will use these technologies. And so over time, the value of being able to work with U.S. companies when non-U.S. persons located abroad are trying to exploit those technologies for bad ends, that value has only increased to a point where collection under Section 702 of FISA informs about two-thirds of the articles that appear in the president's daily brief every day.
So let's go back over this again. You mentioned this once. Who can the intelligence community target under 702, and who can't it target?
The only targets can be non-Americans located not in the United States, non-U.S. persons located abroad. And the statute is very clear about that. Indeed, the statute says, if you target a non-U.S. person abroad because you're really trying to collect on the American they're talking to, that is a prohibition. That is barred by federal law. Now, I don't want to be coy here, Michael, because non-U.S. persons located abroad talk to a lot of people, maybe mostly other non-U.S. persons located abroad, but right. Sometimes Americans, including Americans in the United States. That's not a surprise. That was indeed anticipated as part of the reason for needing this authority in the first place. But all you can target under this authority are the non-U.S. persons located abroad, recognizing that sometimes the most important insight that will give you is that that non-U.S. person outside the country is trying to reach back into this country and run someone who's trying to pick up sources here, or trying to recruit someone to violence, or trying to exploit some vulnerability in our critical infrastructure to lay the groundwork for some harm to Americans. That is part and parcel of being able to see the full expanse of what these non-U.S. persons abroad are doing in their communications. And I'll go one step further, Michael, and say, being able to organize this lawfully collected information around identifiers, not just associated with the targets of collection, but sometimes with whom they're in communication, including those Americans, that has proven critical to disrupting lethal plotting in the United States, to recovering ransomware payments that have had to be made by U.S. companies because of ransomware attacks by foreign actors.
So what does the word target mean? What does that mean in this context, right? Because all this communication is out there. The tech companies have it because the adversaries are using their technology. So what does the word target mean in this context?
I'll get very specific. It is the basis on which the executive branch goes to a technology company and says, we're lawfully authorized to get these communications from you. So imagine, for example, an email address. It's an email address associated with a non-U.S. person located abroad that is being targeted for collection. It is emails associated with that email address that, if it fits within the type of things that the FISA court approves once a year as valid bases for 702 collection, that's the sort of email address that the executive branch can go to a technology company and say, here's why this fits under the court-approved rules. This is a non-U.S. person located abroad email address. Bring back to us email communications associated with it.
Right. So when does the authority expire, and what has to happen for that not to happen?
It expires at the end of the year, by the end of December 2023. It's been on a five-year reauthorization cycle a couple times, and this is the end of this five-year cycle. And this really shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. There's a reason we in the executive branch kicked off the, at least formal, reauthorization process almost a year ago, back in February, with a letter sent by the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to Congress, but it was public for the whole country and world to see. And we said, this is really, really important. This is a critical intelligence collection authority. It provides value on a host of topics. And we promised, and we've since made good on that promise, to spend the year declassifying examples to show just how valuable it is, as well as to talking with Congress about ways in which the statute actually can be improved through this reauthorization. But here we are. We're having this conversation in December, and we are less than a month away from the statutory authority that we find so critical to protecting Americans from a wide range of threats lapsing. Now, I should also answer the second part of your question, Michael, which is what needs to happen to avoid that awful result, I think really damaging result. And what happens is that Congress needs to pass something, some version of 702 reauthorization that actually moves through both houses, that comes to the president, and that's worthy of the president's signature. And there are, in a sense, at least two complications to that at the stage where you and I are having this conversation. One is the substance, and we should get into a bit some substance that we think would really boost, improve this statutory provision through this reauthorization, and some substance that we've made clear for months we think would really be damaging to national security. There's also the question of vehicle. We're running out of time, and we need something that will actually move through both houses and make it to the president and do so quickly, because the end of the month is very, very close at this point.
Clock is ticking. Yeah. So I'm going to go, Josh, I want to go deeper than we did last time you were on the show on several issues. You've already talked about, in general, how important 702 is to keeping the country safe. I know from my own experience how important it is, but I'm hoping you can give us some examples of where 702 has really made a difference to our national security, because I think, you know, it's nothing like examples to help people really think about, you know, what's going on here and how important it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, Americans will probably remember July of last year when the United States located Ayman al-Zawahiri, the global head of al-Qaeda, I think the world's most wanted terrorist at the time, located him in Afghanistan and took action to take him off the battlefield. 702 helped with that. Americans will remember the pretty devastating colonial pipeline ransomware attack. Had repercussions in multiple states and obviously very deleterious ones for a U.S. company. 702 helped us understand who was behind it and indeed recover ransomware payment made during it. Americans are obviously aware of just the brutal war of aggression being waged by Russia in Ukraine and our efforts to continue rallying the world to support Ukrainian sovereignty and ultimately the cause of democracy. 702 has helped us understand the scope of Russian atrocities in Ukraine, including things like the deliberate targeting of fleeing refugees, the forced relocation of Ukrainian children. And these are the sort of things that have helped us make the case to the world that what's happening there is barbaric, appalling, and needs to be resisted. Americans are surely aware of the fentanyl crisis that is taking far too many American lives.
100,000 a year. 100,000 exactly. Lives a year.
And 702 is absolutely critical to understanding a couple of elements of the foreign aspects of that before that drug pours over our border. That includes understanding the precursor chemicals, which tend to move from China to Mexico, as well as the activities by foreign cartels, by those cartels that operate in Mexico and elsewhere, to turn those precursor chemicals into powder and ultimately pills that then become what Americans and others, you know, actually take and die, often without even knowing that they were taking fentanyl. 702 helps illuminate all of that. So honestly, Michael, I would say that if you're an American who cares about virtually any foreign policy topic, any question of homeland security, whether it's Russian atrocities, whether it's PRC hostile activity, whether it's terrorism, proliferation, fentanyl, anything really, 702 provides insights. And an American who cares about these issues or any one of them should care about being weeks away from a statutory expiration that would deprive us of key insights.
Josh, one of the things that I learned during my 33 years at CIA, particularly with regard to interacting with policymakers and with Congress, is that it's critically important to be crystal clear on what's at stake, you know, crystal clear on warnings, right? You don't want to wake up and find out when it's too late that the decision maker, in this case, Congress, right, didn't hear you, didn't understand the significance of what you were saying. So I want to ask you, what are the IC and the administration saying to Congress and to the American people about the risks associated with not reauthorizing 702?
Now, I want to say two things in particular on this that have emerged since you and I last talked, because I think they're really important. One is that December is the time to get this done. There has been some discussion about the statutory expiration versus the expiration of the FISA court approved certs or certifications. And I won't get into all the technical details. I will just say this. December is the time to get this done. Once December ends and this statute lapses, if it is not reauthorized, the value of 702 changes, and that's for the worse. Whatever the view of the legal availability of continued collection, and we know this from the past, there will be a difference in actual cooperation with the government. There's a reason we kicked off this process at the very beginning of 2023. It was because December is a deadline that matters. It matters especially to the companies with whom we work in a court-approved way to get this valuable collection in service of national security. And to whatever extent there is a message percolating that there is somehow a different deadline, I want to be very clear, Michael, taking your point about how valuable it is to be clear on these things, that this is the time to get this done. That's message one. I think message two is that this isn't just risk, it's also opportunity. And I want to be clear, it's a lot of risk, because you've heard in the course of this conversation and our other one just how much the President of the United States, all of us who have the privilege of working for him, the intelligence community, law enforcement, all of us rely on this authority to gain insight into very real threats, and threats that loom very large at this moment as you and I have this conversation, with violence raging in Ukraine, raging in Gaza, and so many global threats that we're contending with. And it's important not to lose the efficacy of this collection, but this is also a chance to improve it. And we have said publicly that we think that. We're not pushing for a clean reauthorization, as it's sometimes called. We're pushing for an improved 702. One in particular that takes some of the reforms that we have made, addressing what are real compliance issues of the past, queries of this database that have not been done in accordance with court-approved rules, and have dramatically reduced those, have dramatically boosted compliance, reduced the number of U.S. person queries of the type that are such a focus of discussion. And we can now take those policy improvements and we can entrench them in statute so that they can't be rolled back by us or by future administrations. So I just want to emphasize that there is both real risk and real opportunity to emerge in the next few weeks with the continued value of 702 collection and enhanced guardrails as well.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Josh Geltzer.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
I just want to add, you spoke eloquently about what 702 does for the president and the president's advisors in the executive branch. You know, Congress is the beneficiary of 702 information as well. Congress is often asked to make national security decisions in one way or another. And so they're a beneficiary of this information, and they will also be at a loss if it's not there.
It's such an important point, Michael. And, you know, this is a program that is overseen by four committees of jurisdiction. Two judiciary committees, two intelligence committees, who see an extraordinary amount of the guts of this program and its implementation. But beyond that, to your point, there is a U.S. Congress that sees the benefit of intelligence collection, including 702-enabled collection. And as Congress grapples with some really hard things, including this very month, about the administration's strong urging that we continue to support Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression, that we support Israel as it ensures that an October 7th never happens again, as we grapple with potential 2001 AUMF, authorization for use of military force, reform, all of this is informed by intelligence. And all of this is informed by 702 intelligence in particular. And Congress should want all of that the same way we want it, not for ourselves, and Congress shouldn't want it for ourselves, but for our shared responsibility of protecting the American people.
Josh, let's focus on U.S. persons, because this at the end of the day might be at the nub of the concerns, right, in Congress. You've already said that U.S. persons cannot be targeted under 702, but what happens if in targeting a terrorist, say, or a proliferator, weapons proliferator, or a narco trafficker, that information about a U.S. person is collected at the same time? What happens to that information?
It's really important to go to this because, as you say, Michael, it's been the focus of a lot of discussion, and rightfully so. So there are court-approved rules in that same annual cycle that we talked about earlier, in which the FISA court looks at the proposed 702 collection for the coming year and reviews how it's been used over the past year and then allows it to go forward. It approves a lot of rules. And among those rules are for the treatment of U.S. person information when, just as you say, those targets of collection, the non-U.S. persons located abroad, find themselves talking to U.S. persons. That gets handled more carefully by the intelligence community. Typically, the identifiers of those U.S. persons are not shown in the same way the non-U.S. persons are shown to the consumers of intelligence. Now, there can be a basis for looking at it if a request is made on the right basis, and you can imagine what that basis is. For example, if there seems to be a imminent hack of a U.S. company, it's more than appropriate, it's probably a responsibility of the U.S. government, right, to figure out what that U.S. company is and warn it, and assuming the company wants the help, work with it to try to fend off that hack, mitigate it if it's already happened, help figure out what data has been exfiltrated, stop the bleeding, so to speak, if it's already underway. So that's a scenario where you want to protect the information, and then you want to figure out if, in fact, there should be at least some people in the U.S. government who know the victim or intended victim so that they can work with that victim. I'll give you another example that's even more complicated, but equally important. We do see in collection, including 702 collection, hostile foreign actors interacting with U.S. persons. And sometimes it can be unclear from the collection whether those U.S. persons are witting of the fact that these are hostile foreign actors interacting with them or unwitting of it. In other words, are they collaborators or are they potentially being exploited, being used as spies or at least being recruited as spies without the knowledge of who's running them, so to speak? Now, you want to figure that out. We, in fact, owe it to those people to figure out. Now, what the answer is will very much affect which path of a fork in the road happens. In other words, if they are spying for hostile foreign power, law enforcement may use other tools to investigate, and ultimately, there may be a prosecution that should happen at the end of that. If they're unwitting, they may deserve a defensive briefing in which they're warned about the real nature of who's in contact with them and what they're trying to do so they can protect themselves, their family, their company, whatever the circumstances. But those are instances where you're going to encounter U.S. person information in 702 collection that's always targeting a non-U.S. person located abroad, and in which you may want to understand a bit about that U.S. person information so that the right action can be taken based on it.
I'm going to say two things here, Josh. One is that I was actually warned, this is after I left government, the U.S. government reached out to me and said, X is trying to do Y to you. Be careful. So incredibly valuable to me, right, as a private citizen to get that warning. And the second thing I want to say is everything we just talked about is also true of traditional intelligence collection under Executive Order 12333, right? Is that right? Correct?
It is also true that under 12333, we're very cautious and careful about presumptively not sharing that U.S. person information that can be swept up when targeting non-U.S. persons abroad, and that at the same time, there may be instances where it's valuable to see that particularity so that you can warn someone or follow up with an investigation. So that's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's flip to U.S. person queries under 702. Explain what those are. Explain under what circumstances such queries can be made. Walk us through that, Josh.
Yeah.
So this is, because this is another tricky issue.
It is. It has been a real focus of public discussion and congressional debate as well. And so once 702 information has been lawfully obtained by the U.S. government, this is a question of how we organize it, how we sift and sort it. And in particular, it is currently approved by the FISA court. Indeed, it's been upheld by three federal courts of appeals, three ordinary circuit courts, that it is constitutional and consistent with the statute itself to organize that information around U.S. person identifiers, even though it was collected by targeting non-U.S. persons located abroad. Let me make this more concrete, Michael. You might identify, whether in 702 collection or otherwise, the contact between a non-U.S. person abroad and a U.S. person. And you want to see, is there more in 702 collection that's already been obtained that would clarify whether that U.S. person's email address, for example, has other contacts such that you realize, oh, this is a witting enabler of foreign spying, or this is someone who appears unwitting, and we should warn them. And it is permissible to organize that already lawfully collected information by querying it using that identifier, that U.S. person's email address. Again, it's all been collected with a focus on non-U.S. persons located abroad, but now there's a question of how you organize it. Now, of course, you could just read everything, in theory at least, once it's been lawfully collected. But as a practical matter, it's not feasible. It's also probably the most privacy-intruding option to simply read everything. So instead, we use queries, or the intelligence community and law enforcement uses queries, the same way we all use queries, right? We search in our emails for key terms so that we organize it more efficiently. We get to the information we need that we already lawfully possess by using query terms. That's what's happening here. Query terms associated with U.S. persons are sometimes used to organize, to sift and sort this already lawfully collected information, because it's often the most interesting and need-to-know part. To understand if there's been outreach to this U.S. person illuminated by 702 collection can help us figure out, indeed has helped us figure out, threats to the lives of U.S. persons, attempts to recruit as spies U.S. persons, attempt to hack U.S. companies. And so that is in some ways the debate. And in particular, if you'll indulge me another minute, Michael, the debate has become whether the executive branch should have to get what some people call a warrant, or at least a warrant-like court order from the FISA court about sorting and sifting this already lawfully collected information at that stage. So having already gone to the FISA court and obtained this under the requisite standards, should the executive branch have to go back to the FISA court to query it again, or to look at the results of a query? And Michael, this is one thing where we have been, to your point earlier about being clear, I think quite clear for months now, which is we think the answer to that is no, resoundingly no, for at least two reasons. One, we just think it's inapt. It's a category error. It is valid to go to courts to obtain information in various settings. We go to certain courts to get warrants under traditional criminal law enforcement. We go to the FISA court in a particularized way to get traditional FISA, Title I of FISA, and we go once a year to the FISA court to get 702 certifications. But it is not a basis in our legal tradition or really our policy tradition to go to courts to organize already lawfully collected information. Maybe more importantly is the second point, which is we think it would be operationally devastating. We think the time it would take to prepare a court filing, which is a serious matter when the U.S. Department of Justice represents the U.S. executive branch before the FISA court, that's a serious filing prepared by lawyers, reviewed by lawyers, submitted to the FISA court, reviewed by FISA court clerks, then adjudicated by FISA court judges, and ultimately ruled on. That, what I just laid out there, is a great amount of time in which to miss actually being able to do something with the information, actually being able to stop the cyber attack, actually being able to disrupt the lethal plot, actually being able to warn someone they're being recruited as a spy. And we think that's the opposite of what the 9/11 Commission, what the commission that came after the Fort Hood shooting warned us to do, which is to fully utilize that which is available lawfully, already lawfully collected, and in the possession of the U.S. government.
Josh, can you give us a concrete hypothetical example of where 702 collection leads the government to want to, say, search my email to find out what's in that 702 body of data. Can you give us a hypothetical?
Yeah. I mean, imagine if in our intelligence, we see a known recruiter of spies in the United States, let's say Russian or Chinese or Iranian, a known recruiter of spies interacting with you. And we know this person sometimes works directly and they sometimes work indirectly. In other words, they sometimes recruit directly and they sometimes rely on others to recruit further or at least identify targets. And based on the interactions we see, focusing only on that non-US person abroad with you, we want to know, what's Michael's role in this? Is Michael someone who's working with this Russian, this Chinese, this Iranian recruiter of spies to find others? Or is Michael unwitting of this? And he's the next one they're trying to dupe into providing information. And so one step the intelligence community might take at that point, and here in particular would likely be the FBI, because they have that homeland mandate, distinctively so, is they might say, well, let's see what else 702 collection has illuminated about Michael's interactions with only non-US persons located abroad, because that's all that's going to be there, because those are the only targets of collection. So they might take the same email address they see that foreign recruiter emailing you at and say, let's organize our 702 collection around that. See if any others have been reaching out to Michael from China, Russia, Iran, wherever this may be. And if you do identify in that existing 702 repository other interactions, it may make very clear your role in this, Michael. It may make very clear that, wow, you're interacting with a lot of people who recruit Americans and doing so quite wittingly and sharing names and other information on Americans whom they should target and passing sensitive information. Or it may indicate that, wow, you think you're getting information you need for a academic project or a commercial project, and there's no indication that you're witting of this. And illuminating that and doing so swiftly will absolutely influence the next step about whether to see you as somebody collaborating in this spying endeavor or being preyed upon in it. And that's an instance where the FBI in particular might want to organize its existing, its already held 702 repository around your email address to see all that will be seen, which is your interactions with non-US persons located abroad.
So if they find out that I am witting, right, and I'm helping a foreign intelligence service spy on Americans, that's a crime, is that information admissible in court or not?
It is in theory, but what happens next, realistically, is they're going to use appropriate tools to learn more about you. That's having gained that initial insight, which is critical. They will then turn to tools that are appropriate for you as a U.S. person on U.S. soil to keep investigating. Those tools might be traditional FISA, those particularized targets that are approved on a case-by-case basis by the FISA court. If they believe you meet the threshold of probable cause that you're an agent of a foreign power, or it might be traditional law enforcement. They might seek a criminal warrant. So what happens, we often try to make clear that 702 collection is overwhelmingly the start, not the end, to key national security-related investigations and ultimately disruptions. It is true, and I want to be candid about this, Michael, that nine times in the history of 702, 702 obtained or derived information has been utilized in criminal prosecutions. All nine times, those were counterterrorism prosecutions. So all nine of them were national security-related matters. And in each of those, consistent with the statutory requirement, the defendant was notified by the government, by the prosecution, about the fact that there was 702 at least somewhere in the chain of the evidence that was being used against them. But that's very rare. Nine times in the history of the program is rare. Often, because this is a foreign intelligence tool, a national security tool, disruption will take some other form. And it is often the start to an investigation, not the end.
You mentioned earlier the congressional oversight, right? Four different committees. Can you walk us through all of the different levels of oversight of the 702 program? And can you talk about any problems that have been found in the past and how they've been dealt with, particularly with regard to the U.S. person in question?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we talk about having three branches of government. All three branches of government are involved in oversight of 702. In the executive branch, lawyers at places like the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Department of Justice are critical to examining 702 implementation I don't mean just making the case once a year to the FISA court, which obviously the Department of Justice does, but on an ongoing basis, reviewing the implementation of 702. So you have the executive branch, then you have the judicial branch. You have ordinary, Senate-confirmed, Article III judges who sit in these periodic rotations as FISA court judges and who once a year scrutinize these huge folders presented to them of how the authority was used over the past year and consider whether it should be reapproved for the coming year. And then you have the U.S. Congress, who receives very detailed information twice a year on 702, how it's used, what value it's yielding, and, to the extent there are, any compliance errors. And that brings me to the second part of your question, which is, this is a complicated program. And complicated programs, it is our responsibility as a government to implement exquisitely, and sometimes mistakes get made. And the important thing is rectifying those mistakes going forward. And in particular, there's been a lot of discussion of compliance errors by the FBI on these U.S. person queries that you and I have been talking about. And in particular, there have been instances identified, thanks to that rigorous oversight, indeed identified largely by Department of Justice's own lawyers, that at times in the past, FBI has used U.S. person queries to organize this information in a manner inconsistent, in the view of DOJ, with FISA court-approved rules. Now, that's unacceptable, and we've done things to rectify. And in particular, a set of reforms was introduced in 2021 that change fundamentally how an FBI agent or analyst interacts with 702 information. Let me make this very concrete. When these compliance errors were happening, if you were an agent or an analyst at FBI and you didn't want to search 702 information because you weren't supposed to for whatever query you were running, you had to remember to opt out. You had to click get me out of 702 information before I run this query. And candidly, Michael, that is a really bad system design. And yeah, it contributed overwhelmingly to these compliance errors of the past. So in 2021, the system was overhauled. Now, and I've sat at the Hoover Building with FBI and seen on their screens how this works, if you want to query 702 information, the U.S. person identifier, you need to click in. And when you click in, something pops up that says, which one of these categories are you in that makes it okay for you to do this sort of query? You need to choose from a drop-down menu. And then another thing pops up, and it says, okay, write in your own words. Give a case-specific written justification for the type of query you want to do. And you write that in, and only then can you actually run that query, which leaves a set of justifications that can be looked at in this oversight process we've been talking about. And from 2021 to 2022, that reform, plus a bunch of others, like higher level reviews for sensitive queries and additional training, all of that yielded a 93% decrease in the number of U.S. person queries run by FBI and an increase in the compliance rate within the queries that were still run. Now, we didn't settle for that. We introduced some additional reforms this year, earlier in 2023. And we think not only are these reforms working, the data show that they're working, but we should take the next step in the next few weeks of working with Congress to take those policy reforms and make them law so that they are sticky, so they can't be undone by us or by a future administration, because they work. We know they work.
So there, Josh, there were some very high profile political cases with regard to surveillance, had to do with President Trump. Those were not 702 related, correct? Those were other programs.
That's right. And this has been part of our effort to do public education on this over the past year, which is whatever one's view of, let's say, Carter Page. That was simply not 702. And whatever one's views of certain criminal prosecutions, that is simply not 702. So we've tried very hard to disentangle what are actually debates about 702 from other things.
Yeah, for sure. Josh, let's finish up with where we are today. As you know, there's a proposal on the table from the chair and ranking of both intelligence committees, right? So the leadership of both committees from both sides of the aisle, what would this proposal keep the same and what would it change in 702 today?
Yeah, and maybe I'll step back and say things a little more abstract from that, in part because we're still studying legislation or draft legislation introduced, in part because those themselves may change even between our having this conversation and
right,
your listeners hearing it, given the markups and other things on the Hill. But I guess I think of things in three categories here. One are things that we've said publicly as an administration we think are meaningful, real changes. And you and I have just talked about one, which there is appetite, it seems, on, at least in parts of the Hill, to do, which is entrench those reforms about U.S. person queries, and in particular queries at FBI that have been the subject of compliance errors in the past, entrench the reforms that we know are working into law. And we've said publicly for months now, we support that. Indeed, we really think that's an opportunity to improve this statute. There are also other things we've said, at least at a generalized level, we support. There are ways to improve transparency with respect to how 702 is used. There are ways to improve proceedings before the FISA court, such as through amicus participation, that we would endorse. So there's one category of things that we see various proposals on the Hill doing that we've already said publicly, either more specifically or more generally, we support. Then there are things in the middle, interesting ideas that have been floated. For example, the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, the PIAB, in a report that I would recommend to all your listeners that came, that was released earlier this yes. summer, not only did the board speak to the absolute criticality of 702 collection, but they floated the idea of either restricting or eliminating so-called evidence of a non-national security crime queries. These are queries that are done to sort and sift 702 collected information, not with respect to foreign intelligence or national security crimes like counterterrorism or counterespionage, but more ordinary crimes where there's a basis, a reason to believe that it will reveal those. And there are some who say this is really a foreign intelligence and national security tool, and those evidence of a crime queries should either be restricted or prohibited. Now, the PIAB says a lot more about its reasons for recommending that, and we've said that's something to think about. That's something to talk about. It has its costs. It has its risks, but it's something to talk about. And then there's a third category, Michael. And here I would point specifically to the idea of a warrant or warrant-like court order for U.S. person queries generally, or U.S. person queries at FBI. I've heard it argued both ways. And here I'd go back to what I said before, which is we both think it is inapt. It's the wrong understanding of what it means to interact with a court, to get approval for collection, to obtain information appropriately and lawfully, but then to sort, sift, organize it as an executive branch, and especially to do so in a way that keeps up with the threats that the information is designed to help us address. Well, we really think it would be operationally devastating on that front. And so that is one where we've been saying for months, we don't accept that. Indeed, we actively oppose it, and we think it would damage the utility of this vital collection tool, not to mention that when 702 was built in the first place, there was always an understanding that some of the most important things one might find in collecting against non-U.S. persons located abroad were their attempts to harm or to interact with, recruit, radicalize, etc., Americans in the homeland, which can be illuminated, at least as a first stage of investigation, by 702 collection, in particular by U.S. person queries. So those are the three categories, Michael. Some things we've said publicly we support, some things we've said publicly we oppose, and then some others that they have costs, they have risks, but we've said we should keep talking about those. But at this point, maybe the last thing I'll say is those conversations need to happen fast, because we've made this case for 11 months now. We are weeks away from a vital statute expiring. We're in a world that can't afford for the U.S. government to have less insight into terrorist threats, proliferation threats, spying threats, Russian threats, PRC threats. It's a world that can't afford that. And so we need Congress to get this passed and reauthorized in a way that maintains its full efficacy and ideally enhances its guardrails too.
Yeah, Josh, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. This is an incredibly important issue, and thanks for taking your time again to talk to us about this.
I'm really grateful for the opportunity, Michael. Thank you.
That was Josh Geltzer. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.